Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 220. Science Faction, we have a new intro bit.
What is that intro bit? You're keeping me waiting. You're stringing it out. Are we going to announce it this episode?
Yeah, it is this episode. We took in a whole bunch of suggestions over the past few months as to what our new intro bit should be. Again, the qualifications, it had to be science-based. It should be something that helps the listeners become more scientifically literate every time they hear another episode. It should be able to be done in a series. At one point, we went through all the elements of the periodic table. We went through the logical fallacies. We've gone through a lot of things. And this one, we're going to talk about
euphemisms for dong.
No, you keep suggesting
synonyms
that.
Synonyms for penis.
No, literally the exact same thing. No, we are going to be speaking about the different sciences. Okay, so this was a listener suggestion. I thought it was brilliant because we can go over a lot of different territory in here. Now, we can take this down to very, very minute levels. We're not going to do that. We're going to talk a little bit more broadly and try and also talk about the interconnectedness of certain sciences with others. I figured why not start off with one that I know the best and one that's kind of alphabetically up there with anthropology.
I'm glad you didn't do archaeology, or that, or you're saving up for a special archaeology episode where we do like three episodes of all archaeology articles.
See, Damien is already messing up, and not surprising. Damien is already messing up because, in fact, archaeology is a sub-discipline within anthropology. So anthropology is basically the study of human beings. It's usually broken down into physical anthropology, which is usually...
The ability to lift.
Yeah. It's deadlifts and curls.
Sweet lats.
Yeah. No, physical anthropology is, the easiest way to say it is the study of evolution, the study of physical change, the study of the physical body of human beings. That was actually my initial interest when I went into anthropology. I wanted to go study with Tim White and learn about, you know, everything from Australopithecus all the way through Homo sapiens, which again, all of our listeners know about because that was one of our intro bits for a while.
Then he got so caught up fighting Cerruti and his mastodons.
That's true. That's true. And then, so we have physical anthropology as one part of it. Archaeology, which is the next part of it, and that's the study of the material remains and culture of human beings. So we wouldn't be looking as much at the physical structure of their skeleton and the bones as the stone tools they make, the art that they might do, the places they live, and the remains they leave behind for us.
When you say the material remains of archaeology, are you referring to of humans or of dinosaurs?
Oh, God damn it. And then the third part, which is usually, anthropology is divided into usually three or four parts, depending on what school you come from. The third part would be cultural anthropology, which is kind of more the study of society and culture within it. Those are the type of people who go off and they live in the Amazon for 10 years with some kind of uncontacted tribe. Now, what is sometimes grouped within cultural anthropology and sometimes put as a separate grouping is, of course, one of our scientist co-host's favorite disciplines, linguistics.
I thought you were going to say sociology.
Oh, yeah.
The rock-hard, not flaccid science of sociology.
Indeed, linguistics is often grouped as part of anthropology because it's the study of humans, in this case, human language. The research is conducted in a wide variety of ways. If you are a physical anthropologist, you are in a lab studying bones. You might be out in the field looking for those bones, but in general, you are doing a lot of detailed lab analysis of the size, shape, and peculiarities of any individual species or group's bones. I did a lot of that in college. It's actually shockingly fun. It's neat to compare the differences between us and Homo erectus. It's neat to see where we came from and how we've evolved over time.
If you're really trying to, you're really speaking to Joe Sixpack there, yeah, listening, right, to this podcast, like sorting bones and disproving God is fun.
Archaeology is done a little differently. Archaeology is much more of a field science. It's you're going out and you're looking for sites, or you're going to sites that you already know exist and either describing them or sometimes excavating them, looking for stuff that's underneath the ground. Whereas cultural anthropology is usually done as a study where you're embedded with a different group and you're studying them, marking their societal groupings, how they have a hierarchy, how their entire society is established, all that kind of stuff.
Now, how do you do this traditionally? Do you integrate as a member of society? Do you dress like two kids on
Yes.
Do you dress like two kids on the shoulders wearing a trench coat?
It's actually referred to as the little rascal science. Researchers work in different parts of it. Like, there's not a lot of cultural anthropologists who are out in the Amazon working for profit. Usually those are university or research-based orientations. Same is true with physical anthropology, whereas archaeology, where I work, in fact, the majority of the research done is done as for-profit cultural resource management stuff, where if somebody wants to build something, they have to hire people like me to come out and go assess sites and protect them, sometimes excavate them, that kind of thing. So depending on what part of anthropology you're in, you're going to be working in very different fields with very different pay scales and the money coming from very different places. The educational process is usually the same in undergrad. In undergrad, most places you specialize just in anthropology, not in a single subdiscipline of it, and then you get your later specialty in grad school. We can talk about some of the fun parts of all of those disciplines. So you don't always just have to sit in a lab and sort bones. Sometimes you're using a laser scanner to make 3D models of what these bones look like so they can be compared in CAD systems.
I thought sorting bones was fun, so you're saying you don't always have to do some fun thing?
That's right.
I'm saying you have a very contradictory message about your field.
Sometimes you're going out and hiking all day. Sometimes you're mapping stuff. There's archaeologists who never leave the lab. They sit there and they map stuff, or they sort through a bunch of debris to pull out artifacts. And there's a lot of interaction with different sciences. You work with chemists and physicists when you're trying to do radiometric decay. So if I need to find the date of something and I have carbon, I'll send a C14 sample out to somebody, and I'm working with chemists or physicists from different sciences.
Are the physicists and chemists, are they, because they work in a more rigid science, are they very cocky? Do they speak down to the people?
No, because we're paying them money, so that would be a bad move on their part. Oftentimes you work with people in geography for mapping. You work with other people in chemistry for things like protein residue analysis. You even look into fields like psychology because of how our intents influence actions.
Bobby, come on. Geology. How have you not mentioned geology
yet? I'm not familiar with that science. I don't know. Maybe we'll cover it at some point.
I really hope so, because I feel really upset right now.
Sometimes you work with microbiologists to look at the effect of bacteria on physiology. You work with computer scientists to do computer modelings of ancient cultures. You can look at biology for human functioning, zoology for the involvement with other animals, ecology when you're looking at the human place in the environment, and even things like astronomy.
Homeopathy.
No, not homeopathy. Though that might be an interesting sociocultural study about...
study of watering down.
Yeah. And sometimes you even work with astronomy as the knowledge of heavens gained through observation altered ancient hegemonic practices. So astronomy actually plays into a lot of the power structures of Mayan civilizations, and knowing that helps you out. And then occasionally, I don't know, you get some weird science like, what did you say? Geology?
It's pronounced geology.
Okay.
And I believe all your remains...
studying gangsters, yo.
Yes, the OGs, the original geologists.
And speaking of the original geologist, I, of course, am your host, comedian archaeologist Robert Timothy. With me, as always, is my comedian, Mr. Damian Mercado. Damian, how are you doing this afternoon?
Doing great. By the way, as a geologist, you probably should promote your field more. I was trying to think of one famous geologist. I've been doing a science podcast for years now.
Yeah.
Blank. Nothing.
There aren't any famous ones. I've never even heard of it. And of course, our newest scientist guest host, welcome to the show, Alyssa. How are you doing?
Hello, I'm doing great.
Now, Alyssa, as was hinted at, your specialty is this obscure geology?
Yes, I believe it's a study of the rocks in which you find all of said remains and bones that you study. So, you know, it might come in handy
every once in a while
your field.
It's the stuff he throws away.
Yeah, that's true. Screw those rocks.
It's a shame.
So what is your specialty within geology? What do you study?
So I'm actually a marine geochemist, and I study biogenic carbonates, which is just a fancy way of saying carbonates that are formed from marine organisms. So shells and hard parts and coral skeletons.
So you're not even really studying rocks. You're studying like the skeletons of old animals.
Well,
you're like a paleontologist in a way, right?
I mean, paleontology is a subdiscipline of geology.
Okay.
So if you want to get specific...
So you're a Marine? That's what I got? Like, hoorah, thank you for your service.
And if you're interested in marine geology, go ahead and check out our website at www.thesciencefaction.com, where we'll have all the articles we cover here, as well as some we didn't get to. But for now, let's move right on to science articles.
From molecules to particles, this is Science Articles.
I'm picturing how marine geologists are trained in a barracks with a big guy in a round hat in your face. What type of geode is this motherfucker?
I mean, I'm not going to lie. My master's advisor was pretty intense, but, you know.
He had the wide brim hat, a lot of starch in it.
He definitely yelled at me a lot.
Yeah. Did a lot of push-ups.
Yeah.
The rifle, I felt, was a little much. Didn't think he needed that. All right, article number one, a new human organ discovered, and it might be the biggest internal organ in our body. Very interesting story. One of those ones with a catchy headline that turns out like it might actually have some validity to it.
We're not just talking about some morbidly obese man's like enlarged heart.
Right.
We're talking about
something everybody,
new.
All human beings, indeed. So this is kind of interesting because it is kind of one of those things where you wonder how can we have an organ that's the biggest internal organ in our body and we haven't discussed. It's 2018. How is that possible? Well, here's how it is possible.
Well, as somebody with one of the largest external organs.
Right.
I find it, my nose.
Oh, okay. I got you. I see. So this was really interesting because it was actually found by accident. Now, we knew that we had these channel ducts, these things that essentially conduct liquid. We knew that they had them in part of the body. In fact, in an endoscopy procedure where they basically put a camera up a certain part of you, that you could look
at. What part?
Your nose.
No, but that came later.
This thing smells terrible.
We know that we had these channels around bile ducts that carry bile to the gallbladder and to the small intestine. We've known that those existed for a while, but we thought they were a localized phenomenon in that area. What basically happened is they pulled the camera out of where it was, and then another researcher decided, let's see what's in my nose, and did put it up his nose.
A picture you would say like comes in with his research, so right. You wash the thing, right? That's not important to the study, okay? It's not important how I discovered this.
And he looked in and he found very similar channels, and he was able to see them because, again, this is a kind of mucous membrane. You essentially have a little window into your body, and he was able to see that these channels existed up there. Now, up there, they're obviously not carrying bile around. In fact, they're filled with just liquid. They're filled with fluid. The thought is that these exist throughout the body. Now, this is not yet proven, but it looks like, based on the similarities of what they see in the nose and what they see down by the bile ducts, that this entire thing might constitute a huge mass of tissue that goes throughout the body. Right now, they're not sure what it's for. They think it might be literally a shock absorber. Like, this thing fills up with water up to a fifth of the body's volume of fluid. And then it's literally a shock absorber. It is like a waterbed that you carry around underneath your skin that keeps you from taking too much kinetic damage.
So if we didn't have this as humans, just roughhousing as a child, every child would have CTE by the time they're...
I will tell you this. What's really interesting is the... now, again, it's speculative that this is an organ. It's speculative that this is the biggest internal organ in the body. It's very speculative as to what the cause is and what it functions as. However, one thing that is interesting to note is that fighters, either boxers or MMA fighters, who have to dehydrate to make weight, dehydration before a fight is strongly correlated with brain damage. So one might speculate, yeah, you lose the fluid, you lose essentially this layer of cushioning that your body has naturally, and you are much more likely to maintain serious damage. So they were basically saying, we have this giant internal organ. Again, we have to say internal organ because the biggest organ, as most of you guys will know, is the skin, your skin on the outside of your body.
Wait, couldn't it be bigger than the skin, though, if it's this mesh material? Because it would actually potentially have a higher surface area if it really goes around.
If it would,
all the tissue.
Under the condition that it was thicker than the skin, and I think what they believe is that it is not, that these are small channels.
Okay.
To address Alyssa's point, do these channels just cover internal organs? Or if, let's say, no. I'm a morbidly obese man, does it cover my fat? As I gain in mass, does it gain in mass as well?
We're not sure yet. Again, you have to look past the nose and the bile ducts. But the idea would be that it does go throughout the body and provide some kind of shock absorption system to most of your vital functions. Would be very, very interesting if we discovered this truth. A lot of you guys might be thinking, like, wait a second, how did it take till 2018 to find this? How is that even possible? Well, the answer is, in most situations in which you would come in contact with this, either as a physiologist, as a medical doctor, as a research doctor, you're not going to be seeing these things inflated. They're not going to have the fluid in them. They will have drained. So if you think of a dead body, that's going to be drained out when you're doing an autopsy. If you think of surgery in a live person, as you cut it, you are essentially releasing the liquid from those channels. It would just appear as hard, deflated, flat tissue that is kind of connected near the skin. You wouldn't necessarily note it as an organ. You would just think of it as this tissue that is accompanying the rest of the body, and it's very small and thin when it doesn't have water in it. So it's very easy to overlook and very easy not to notice. Now, again, cautious skepticism. We don't know that this is true.
Well, it's a good thing we're covering it on a science podcast then.
Well, it's very interesting because the speculation that it could be true would totally upend physiology in a lot of ways. But we do know it exists in the nose and the bile ducts. It will be interesting to see researchers try and find ways to locate the extent of these, how far they reach across the body, whether or not it is a uniform single thing, or it's just little pockets of these, which would then not be the largest internal organ anymore.
Something like this would make sense because, Bobby, you and I have grown up knowing people who have broken bones just catching a football.
Yes, that's true.
But I have hit you with my car not once, not twice, but thrice.
Yep.
And you have never broken anything. No. You are a hydrated man,
sir. I am incredibly hydrated, and that is what I attribute my success to.
Me pushing you like a Russian coach. I will hit you with car if you do not succeed at grades.
What are you, a geology marine over here? It reminds me of back in 2016 when we reported on the fact that we found a new ligament in the knee. You know, after hundreds of years of physiology, it turns out there's a tiny little ligament that somehow people had missed for hundreds of years when doing autopsies and knee surgeries and lots of other things. And we found out there was a whole new ligament. There are parts of our body that we do not know yet.
Is it because the people who do like the dissecting, are they like the F students of medical school? Like the
they're
guys?
The people who didn't have the bedside manner.
You work with the dead people. Just...
So my question to you guys, what do you think the next mystery of the human body to be discovered will be? We talked about that ligament. This might be a huge new discovery. What is the next thing we're going to discover that was right in front of our nose about the human body that we have missed all this time?
Wow. I don't know. I would say probably some of like the most interesting discoveries recently have been like the gut microbiome.
Yeah, that's very true.
And all the crazy stuff going on down there and people doing, you know, stool, like, what do you call them?
Fecal transplant.
Fecal transplant. I couldn't think of the name of it.
Damien has a Twitter account called Fecal Transplant.
What do you post on there?
You don't want to know.
I don't want to know, yeah.
You know what? Exactly what you were thinking. In fact, the same thing when you're thinking when you said people doing stool, like homeless people, like doing poop.
Just
like,
doing poop.
Let's trade gut microbiomes, man. You got me?
That and the end scene to Requiem for a Dream. That is all that is posted. All right.
They were just swapping gut microbiomes, you know?
That's actually a really interesting point, though, because we have talked before about not only the gut microbiome, how it affects immunology, how it affects some depression in some cases, how it affects physiology, health, a bunch of other stuff. But more and more, we're finding there are other microbiomes. Females have a vaginal microbiome. We all have a nasal microbiome and an oral microbiome. And all of these seem to affect our health, which is why we can have long-lasting effects if we use a lot of antibiotics. And I'm not an anti-antibiotic guy. You need it sometimes, but it can have long-lasting effects on your body because it's wiping out these things that we need.
Building on Alyssa's point, I think we're going to find out that we don't need fancy doctors or science to help us swap gut microbiomes. You could do it on the corner if you wanted to.
And you have. All right, on to article number 2, stem cells cure binge drinking in mice. Very interesting study published in Nature.
Published in Lame Mouse Monthly.
These are like the non-cool mice.
They finally were tolerable to hang out with in short bursts.
What they're looking at is mice that chronically binge drink. And I know that might seem like a weird thing. Like, we just have these, like, frat boy mice that are hanging around. They have a hat on backwards. They're yelling racial epithets out their mice cage.
Listen, don't leave your mouse drink unattended at one of their parties. Can't stress this enough.
Basically, you can genetically predispose these mice to binge drink and then give them either water or ethanol and alcohol, and they have the option to have either one.
Oh my God, this explains so much.
I know, and we've talked about this before. The
cool mouse studies?
Yeah, cool mouse studies. Like, the mouse you want to be. You don't want to be the mouse in the study where they're like, okay, we're going to shock its genitals every time it sees a blue light, but you do want to be the let's get fucked up mouse study. You want to be on the, let's give a bunch of LSD to these mice.
Yeah. Genetically predisposed to get drunk.
Yeah. Like, these mice party.
Story of my life.
Yeah, can we do some crossover with the nympho mouse study in the lab tank across the way?
Yeah, so they were in an animal model where they had basically chronic ethanol intake, and they would relapse. If they took it away, the mice would relapse into alcoholism once again. Not necessarily surprising. And this isn't just alcoholism in the sense that they would chronically drink. It was that they would binge drink, which is actually a whole separate thing, because binge drinking actually affects the brain. If you get super wasted on a regular basis, you are doing certain damage to your brain that has a lot to do with inflammation, parts of the brain routinely being shut down. It's a big difference between even a chronic alcoholic, which is in itself dangerous, and a chronic binge drinker. So what they wanted to see is if certain stem cells injected into the brain in these parts where we see this type of inflammation could actually cut down on the mouse's cycle of binge drinking. In other words, can you interrupt that cycle of binge drinking, use stem cells to treat the damage that's occurring to the brain, and then because this damage acts like a feedback loop, the worse it gets, the worse they want to binge drink, stop or at least hold back some of the binge drinking. So they had these mice, got super party mice, right? You have this big group. Super drunk party mice, alcoholics, binge drinkers. Then you take half of them, put them in a control group, and you inject essentially saline into their brain. And you take the other half and you put in stem cells and repair a lot of the damage that is caused both by the inflammation and the drinking itself. All right, so the question is, you know, one, does this reduced inflammation and the lack of binge drinking that accompanies it that we see in these mouse models, which is significant because, again, 80 to 90% of the ones in the control would go back to binge drinking shortly thereafter. These mice did not. Would that translate over to humans? Does our brain work in the same way? Would we have the same inflammatory problems? Would human beings be affected by this type of stem cell direct treatment directly into the brain in the same way that these mice are?
Now, I'm not saying that alcohol doesn't destroy lives, but is this the best use of stem cells given that they're a cheat code for everything?
Yeah, well, I mean, sometimes you need to get a cheat code for binge drinkers, right?
Also, I feel like there are other reasons why people drink aside from inflammation.
Sure, right? yes, but you gotta, you gotta think about it. Like, a lot of the times people are drinking because they have problems, right? Or because they feel that alcohol solves some of these problems. One of the reasons you feel that way is a continual cycle that happens because of the inflammation in parts of your brain and the damage that you're doing to parts of your brain.
Right, but do mice have problems? Like, what are mice problems?
Yeah, there's a lot of, like, he shat in my side of the corner, like...
In the lab, all of the mice can see all the other experiments happening around them. The castration study happening right next to
them. I don't want to be part of there. Or it's Schadenfreude, and they're like, yeah. Maybe that's it. Maybe it had nothing to do with the stem cells. It was just which mice these mice were put next to.
The Stanford mouse experiment.
When I consider the effects of alcohol, I like to think of a society in which you just introduce alcohol and how that would affect things differently. So if you think of our society, Western culture outside of shamanistic traditions had no concept of hallucinogenics until the 1960s, until the 50s at least, with the synthesis of LSD. And at that point, you had a whole new drug culture come in. They had known about being drunk. They knew about cannabis. They knew about opium and cocaine. They did not know about hallucinogens. And once they came in, people were like, well, this is weird. These people are tripping out. You know, they're behaving very weirdly. And that was a big shock to the system. And it took something, which is hallucinogens, which by all scientific measures are one of the safest drugs to do and actually can cause some long-term beneficial wellness. It took one of those drugs and made it highly illegal as heroin. That's crazy. Think of a culture in which you just introduced alcohol that never had it before. We're used to it, so we just go with it. We're like, oh yeah, sometimes you get too drunk and throw up. They'd be like, you throw up? What are you fucking talking? That's crazy. And you're like, yeah, and don't drink too much because you'll literally die. And they're like, what? I could smoke all the weed in this room and there's no way I could die. You think of the juxtaposition of the damage that alcohol does. It's dramatically bad for us. It's actually over and over again shown to be one of the worst drugs for our culture and our people.
I completely agree with you. The way we classify and legalize drugs is way off. And alcohol is very harsh on the body. But I am picturing that person from a Neanderthal or some sort of early human.
Right.
Who's never seen alcohol before. All of a sudden, you put him Cancun spring break.
Oh, yeah.
I'll tell you what he'll think. The future's an incredible place.
The movie is called Encino Man.
Yeah. I saw that documentary.
Put him in the middle of in the suburbs of Los Angeles. Send him to high school.
I mean, alcohol is super dangerous. Alcohol and barbiturates are the only drugs in which detoxing will kill you. So you can be the biggest heroin addict in the world for 30 years. You quit heroin the next day. You'll go through some hard times. You'll have flu-like symptoms, but you will not die. You will be just fine. You're a big-time alcoholic, even been drinking heavily only for a year or so, you go cold turkey, you will die. It's a scary drug when you take it out of the cultural context that we have it in. And if you could stop binge drinking, which accounts for a lot of damage that alcohol causes, both chronic alcoholism and binge drinking account for such a significant amount of violence in our culture, ambulance calls, drunk driving, all this kind of stuff. If you can find any way to alleviate, let's say 10% of those symptoms, think of the overall societal benefit most Western cultures would have.
Maybe some of us grew up with abusive parents, and yes, mm-hmm. alcohol was to blame, but I know my dad, and he might have done more without the release that alcohol
provided. At least he passed out by 9:30. Otherwise, what if he was up all night? It's an interesting thing because if we solve certain problems, you know, it's like the energy thing. We were talking about fusion generation the other day and how fusion generation would totally change mankind forever. We'd have unlimited power source.
The wrestler or the species?
The actual generation of electricity by use of fusion reactors. Okay. We would have unlimited energy sources. We would be done with carbon problems because we could sequester carbon that's already in the atmosphere and we wouldn't continually put more in there. There are certain things that if we solve would very much change humanity. And I feel like solving alcoholism is one of them because it's one of those things where a tiny percentage of very bad actors can very much damage to the broader. It's like psychopaths. You know, if you took away psychopaths, you would take away a significant amount of our prison population.
Right. But even if you get rid of alcoholism, you're still going to have people that get shit faced and do terrible things, right?
Yes.
Like Bostonians.
Yes. Yes. The idea is to keep them from doing it.
I'm beating my
perpetually.
Wife, but I don't know why.
Yeah. Like, if you can stop them, we have to all understand that somebody's going to take it too far. That's always going to happen. We want to stop the cycles that allow it to perpetuate. And I think one of those is things where the brain is constantly seeking the same reward system. And it looks like in this case, they were able to interrupt that cycle, and that helped out a lot. Those are things where I think people overlook them, but those tiny targets would cause a large-scale change. I've said this before. If you had a brain test for psychopaths that you could take when the kid was born. Now, look, most psychopaths don't end up hurting people physically. They usually torture those family members around them. They're horrible human beings, the whole nine yards. But
most CEOs of Fortune 500 companies.
They're
president of the United States.
Narcissist and sociopath.
Yeah. He's definitely not a psychopath. He doesn't have the emotional control.
I study rocks. I don't know.
He could be the most disciplined psychopath of all time. Said, this is my character, and I'm sticking to it. This is what I envision when I see humans.
He's psychopath improv captain? Yeah, okay. If you did that, now look, most of them do not go in jail, but it's estimated that 30 to 50% of people in jail, at least in male prison, are psychopaths. They only make up 1 to 4% of the general population. So you would drastically cut down on a lot of that. And then there's the other theory that a lot of the other people who aren't psychopaths in prison are the way they are because they were tortured by people who were psychopaths.
Because they were serial raped by a psychopath.
Yeah, exactly. Imagine if you could do a brain scan and just be like, sorry, this one's got to go. Like, this kid cannot be here, or you find a treatment for it, whatever it is. But you don't just allow psychopaths to run wild through society. We would cut down crime. We would be like Japan. Like, it would be beautiful. There'd be no crime, no litter. Everybody would be nice. They'd wait in lines.
Unfortunately, the big supervillain lobby owns Washington, so we'll never get legislation like that passed.
But this is an interesting use for stem cells. Before I read this, I would not have thought stem cells would be the way you would try and work on alcoholism. I would think it would be cognitive behavioral therapy.
God.
I always like those drugs where either they have like a Narcan-like effect. You know, Narcan reverses heroin. So if somebody's overdosing on heroin, you give them some Narcan and essentially the effects go away. But also, they will do it sometimes to people who are heroin addicts to take their high away. And there's new technologies like that are essentially vaccinations against heroin, where you are training your immune system to bond to and fight the active opium ingredients so that it doesn't matter how much you inject, you cannot get high. I always thought something like that for ethanol would be kind of a way that it might work. But the idea that stem cells would be the way to go on this, I would not have called that.
There are those medications that make you allergic to alcohol, right?
Yes.
And how long do they last?
I think it's like a month.
I always thought that'd be the greatest like prank, like back when you and I used to prank each other.
Back before spring break, right before your friends are about to go party in Mexico for a while.
Yeah, just okay, now you're the DDD for the rest of the trip.
That is a good one. It is interesting that this technology came from stem cells. Here's a good question. What do you guys think will be the next unexpected advantage that we find from using stem cells?
Are they growing animals yet?
Are they growing animals? Technically, we've been growing animals for a couple billion years.
Sweetest hogs this side.
Like regenerating endangered species from stem cells.
I don't know if you do it from stem cells. I mean, I think that's more of like a, harvesting eggs and doing fertility type stuff. But, I mean, there could be a situation where you are using some form of stem cells to help produce much more eggs and sperm and therefore increase chances of those dividing. That would work.
I would like to use stem cells to cure autism by using it to repair the damage done by vaccinations.
Oh, God damn it. This is what he reads one Wakefield study, and then he just wants to pull
it. Plastered on my wall. I recite it like idiots recite the Constitution.
Keeps referring to Dr. Jenny McCarthy. Yeah, it is interesting. I think that, we've seen some of the interesting uses in terms of, can we grow new organs? Can we maybe repair certain things like skin that has been taken off and without using a graft? I think some of the super interesting stuff from stem cell technologies will come with inherited genetic diseases or genetic flaws, things like sickle cell anemia. Will we be able to use certain stem cell treatments to repair the damage in the case of somebody who's homozygous for the sickle cell trait and keep them from manifesting the actual sickle cells that end up killing them?
What if I just wanted to use it to get washboard abs?
The sickles? Oh, the stem cells?
Sickle cells, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I was wondering how you were doing
all
that
the time. I wouldn't.
You're like, look at me. I can't get malaria. Look at these abs. All right, let's
lost all that malaria weight.
Let's move right on to everybody's favorite game. I call BS.
I call.
I call.
I call.
I call.
I call.
Ring, ring.
I call BS.
It is not even the favorite game of everybody on this show.
It is.
She's never played it before. It's sure as shit not my favorite game.
I believe it is your favorite game. In fact, Damien, minus 1 point in the beginning. I call BS.
No.
You're already starting from a negative.
This show needs a judiciary to keep you in check.
Do I get a prize?
Yes, you absolutely do. And you will undoubtedly win because he loses literally every show.
Oh boy, no pressure.
Yeah, please participate in this Milgram experiment.
For those of you who don't know, I call BS is a game where I read 4 science articles, and then my panelists compete to see which ones are real and which ones are BS, standing for bad science. Are you guys ready to play?
So ready.
Yeah, I'm ready to play. Why not? Let's push this rock up a hill again.
Exactly. I wish you'd win one time. All right. Article number 1. A new technology will allow solar panels to generate electricity from rain. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is bad science. Scientists have discovered a way to make solar panels generate electricity from not rain, but maize.
God damn it. All right, and Alyssa.
That's Alyssa, the Native Americans word for corn.
Damien likes to sneak the word maize in unexpected times throughout the show just to annoy me because he's unable to win this game.
I think I'm going
to
be terrible at this game because I'm really gullible. I was like, oh, fascinating.
Just corn flapping on solar panels. Right? It's working.
Yeah. No. Challenging. I would say this is science. I feel like there's probably some crazy engineer out there that figured out a way to either make, the generation of electricity more efficient somehow via rain, or storage more efficient via rain. So.
I like the idea of a crazy researcher. I imagine Doc Brown, and he's like, Marty, I got these new solar cells.
We're moving to Seattle.
All right, article number 2. Researchers have just discovered that a chemical in the tears of male mice make female mice less willing to have sex with them. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is bad science. It is the other way around. Because every time I see a crying female mouse, I don't want to have sex with it.
Oh, okay. This would be the male mice crying, Damien.
What if she starts crying after sex?
That's what I'm saying the other way around. I am saying bad science. Okay. It is actually... And after sex? I should just assume it is an ovational cry. It is a... Like, that it was such a beautiful act that I just saw. It was art performed on a dick canvas.
Dick canvas was Damien's porn name. All right, and Alyssa.
I mean, I want this to be true so badly, but I could see it going both ways, you know? Like, sometimes when a man cries, it's a turn-on, right? Because he's, like, emotional, and he knows how to, like, actually communicate his emotions, which is really nice. But then other times, there are certain situations when a man cries, and it's the biggest turn-off ever. So I'm trying to think how Mouse feels. I'm also wondering if she's one of the binge-drinking
mice. Yeah, is she an alcoholic mouse or not?
That makes a difference. I'm going to call bad science.
And article number 3, a new study suggests that the largest hypercarnivore of the late Pleistocene, the short-faced bear, which is a science faction favorite, was actually sometimes a plant eater. Now, for those of you guys who haven't listened long enough and heard us rant about one of our favorite animals, the short-faced bear, bigger than a grizzly, bigger than a polar bear, gigantic bear that was around until about 10,000 years ago.
More pissed off, the Yosemite Sam of bears.
Would attack, kill, eat, maim large megafauna, including giant ground sloth. These things were beasts, and they were terrifying. There's some thoughts that they just their presence alone kept human beings out of North America for tens of thousands of years. They were scary, they were fast, and if you ever want to see, go look up a picture of this thing, imagine running into it in the wild. Anyway, we're the short-faced bears, sometimes plant eaters.
This is science. I know you said plant eater specifically, mm-hmm. but I can remember one time a story I heard about a short-faced bear who painted himself as a rain cloud and had a bunch of balloons so he could get it some bees' honey.
Oh, yes. I don't think that's the same type of short-faced bear.
I know that honey's not meat.
That's right.
Which means has to be omnivore science.
That would be an omnivore Pooh Bear indeed. And Alyssa.
I'm going to say this is science because when you're a big animal like that and you're mostly eating other large animals, there's going to be times where you go without. And so you have to find other sources of food. So from time to time, I could see him, getting some honey, like Damien said, or other plants to sustain himself.
Getting stuck in a rabbit hole.
Sometimes it's like the Mounds commercial. Sometimes you feel like a nut. All right. And article number 4, the oldest Homo sapien footprint ever uncovered was just discovered in British Columbia at 13,000 years ago. Damien, is this science or bad science?
Hello,
Jane Goodall here.
Oh, God damn it.
I'm going to answer for Damien.
I bet you there's a Sasquatch banging joke in there somewhere.
Well, you bring up a pretext to summon Jane Goodall, which is mentioning footprints of my lover,
okay,
Mr. Sasquatch.
I see.
And you expect me not to name drop the Sasquatch?
Now, Jane,
or promote Sasquatch D?
These would be Homo sapien footprints, not Sasquatch footprints.
That's why I'm saying bad science.
Okay.
Because this is, in fact, a Sasquatch, or perhaps whatever sapien scientist got it drastically wrong. But assuming they're competent, I'm going to say it's bad science. Jane Goodall out!
But wait, I just want to clarify, because it was a Bigfoot who was mistaken for a Homo sapien, it would be a Bigfoot with small feet.
Jane Goodall back in. Most big and tall stores will sell a trench coat and hat that will fit most Sasquatch. Shoes, out of the question. Cord pieces, out of the question.
So you're saying he wore tiny shoes. That's the idea.
Yes.
Okay, fair enough.
Goodall out!
At least you got a scientific explanation. All right, and Alyssa.
I'm going to say this is bad science. And I think because glaciers would have erased the footprints.
Okay.
That's my answer. British Columbia.
Let's go glaciers. Back and see how you guys did. Follow along at home and see how you did.
I had to
did.
Get geology in there somehow.
And know? They were both scientific answers.
Article number one. A new technology will allow solar panels to generate electricity from rain. Damien thought this was false. Alyssa thought this was true. And this one is science.
Woo!
And a very cool idea. So think what happens to solar panels in a midday rain. They no longer produce electricity because there's cloud cover, so they're not getting sunlight, which causes the photovoltaic effect, so they're not making any electricity. But they are interacting with a form of energy during every rainstorm, and that's kinetic energy. It's literally the energy of those raindrops falling on the panels. Chinese researchers have developed a triboelectric nanogenerator, or TENG, that can be added to solar panels to capture the energy of that motion of the raindrops hitting them, which is really cool. And the way they want to do it is, it wouldn't just be like another generator that's like off on the corner of the solar panel, because that would only interact with the amount of surface area it has. This is actually a layer of clear film that goes over the solar panel. This clear film produces electricity each time a raindrop or anything hits it, but it doesn't affect the solar cell itself. So the solar cell can keep producing electricity when the sun is up and goes right through that clear film. When it's raining, day or night, it is using the energy of those falling raindrops to create electricity. That is awesome.
Could we also generate electricity in innovative new ways by using these same solar cells by allowing high school marching bands to practice their services?
Oh, I see. So you have instead of coating a solar cell, you coat the bass drum and then you let the guy hit it. Yeah.
Bass drum? I'm talking snare, but fine, big boy.
Very interesting stuff. Very neat, because it would expand. If we just added this and this was just part of solar panels indefinitely, it would expand the range in which solar panels were viable to places like Seattle.
I suppose you could use it on a gong as well.
They were Chinese researchers. Article number two. Researchers have just discovered that a chemical in the tears of male mice make female mice less willing to have sex with them. Both of you guys thought this was false, and this one is bad science.
Oh, sexy bitches.
It is the opposite, actually. It makes them more likely to do so. Either way, Damien, I don't know about you. When Alyssa was saying, yeah, sometimes a guy's crying and you want to have sex with him, I was like, what? Where did this happen?
But she also said it was the least attractive thing.
We're confusing. Women are confusing, okay?
Yes, you are. Stop doing that. Stop having sex with that guy.
Like crying after a puppy dies.
It depends. Exactly. It depends on the situation. If it's a situation where I want to be comforted and they don't cry, that's sexy. If it's a situation where I want to see them show more emotion, then that's sexy if they cry.
What if I'm crying because I'm not getting what I want? Is that?
Not sexy.
Okay.
No, never.
By the way, that wasn't even the new research article published. It just happened to be something I saw and was like, wait a second. Female mice will bang you if you're crying?
I'm learning so much about mice right
P.S.
now.
Next time Damien goes to the pet store with all the mice, he brings an onion. Come on, ladies. What the article that came out was actually looking at the pheromones in rat tears, which function the same way. So the way that this happens is there's pheromones in the tears. There are pheromones in rat tears that also attract female rats. However, mice have learned to pick up on this because rats eat mice in nature. They predate on them. Mice have learned to sense this pheromone that are in rat tears that are used as a sexual pheromone and know to be wary because predators are nearby. So it's really interesting interaction of two different species that use tears to attract a mate, but one species has kind of tapped into that special signal and used it to avoid their predators.
So if a plutonic male and female mouse are watching Fried Green Tomatoes together.
Yes.
And by the end, there's a strong likelihood that that male mouse will force himself upon the female mouse.
Well, no, here's what I would be saying. Because again, it is the female mice being attracted to the male mice. So you have to find a movie that would make guys cry. So if you're watching like a Saving Private Ryan or Big Fish, that mouse is getting laid. Yeah.
She's on her phone the whole time.
Or Rocky.
Yeah.
He won.
Yeah.
He went the distance with the champ.
Now
he loses.
Yeah, but he went the distance with the champ in the first one. The rest of the movies, his win percentage is very high.
Article number 3, a new study suggests the largest hypercarnivore of the late Pleistocene, the short-faced bear, was actually sometimes a plant eater. Both of you guys thought this one was science, and this one is science.
Yeah.
And very interesting. We thought of these guys like polar bears, which are total carnivores. We thought that this was the largest land carnivore of the Pleistocene at that time. And they were. A lot of them were, and they were for a long time. However, it was discovered by detailed study of the teeth of these bears that some of them switched to plant eating during times of climate change that would cause basically their food sources to be down.
Boom. Nailed it.
Here's what's super interesting. The ones they found that did have plant material or the evidence of plant material in their teeth were at the La Brea tar pits, whereas the ones in the northeastern North America basically stayed straight carnivores. So it was only the Southern California bears that dabbled in vegetables and fruit. Like, those were the veganish bears. Yeah. They still ate meat, but like,
They wore suspenders needlessly.
Yeah, it was the weirdest thing. They could tell the difference, too, because the Southern California ones were wearing Birkenstocks. And so they're like, oh, these are different bears.
They were much more educated than a lot of the bears found around, just on average.
That's true.
A lot more bachelor's degrees than bears found elsewhere in the country.
It's a very different picture of this bear from this carnivorous monster that dwarfed a polar bear to a more grizzly bear-like cuddler. You know, a little omnivore grizzly bear. But
again, buy a Coke from a short-faced bear.
No, not at all. Or Coke from a short-faced bear. They will rip you off and then maul you.
Tons of baby laxatives.
Yeah. Very, very interesting. They're still insanely scary creatures. Go look them up. And lastly, article number 4. The oldest Homo sapien footprint ever uncovered was just discovered in British Columbia 13,000 years ago. Both of you guys thought this was bad science. And this is bad science, meaning Alyssa, you have won your very first game.
I did it.
Of I Call BS, dominating Damien. Brutally beating him down back into his gimp cage.
Congratulations, Alyssa. You beat me fair and square.
Sore
yes,
lizard.
I agree, Alyssa. Strong women. We both got that answer correct.
Yes, lady scientist.
Yes, let's go trolling for some Sasquatch D later.
I hear Sasquatch is crying. Let's mount that guy.
By the way, for anybody new to the show, Jane Goodall is insane. I'm not making fun of her for no reason. Jane Goodall believes in Sasquatch.
She's
I perhaps took some liberties with the lover part.
She is kind of crazy. All right. There was, sorry to let you know, Alyssa, you were right for the wrong reasons. There was actually a 13,000-year-old footprint found in British Columbia. In fact, there were 29 of them. They seem to represent 2 adults and 1 child. This looks to be one of, if not the oldest footprints known in North America, but far from the oldest footprints of Homo sapien. In fact, we have Homo sapien footprints at 120K in South Africa, 20K in Australia and Tanzania. So we have older Homo sapien footprints. This wouldn't be the oldest ever Homo sapien footprint, just the oldest one in North America.
I got nothing. She won. I'm crestfallen.
But very interesting. We have a few of these really old sites in the Americas. I'm super interested in the occupation of the Americas. We have
inventor, innovator. These are the occupations of the Americas. Okay.
No, the occupation of the America by human beings, we think now happened somewhere between 16 and 20 some odd thousand years ago. We are finding sites that keep pushing that date back further and further. We have the Tulum, Mexico skull, which is like 13,000 years old. We have some 14K dates down in South America, of all places, actually near the south end of South America, in sites like Tres Ventanas. We have the Paisley Caves in Oregon, which have human coprolites at 14,900. So we keep going back. We keep finding older and older stuff. Right now, the oldest site technically in North America is in Alaska, and it's 20-some-odd thousand years old, but that doesn't really count because that's still part of Beringia, where we knew people were. We're talking about below kind of the ice sheet North America. These are one of the older ones. And again, oldest Homo sapien footprints in North America.
Are the Paisley Caves of any relation to the Pasty Caves?
No.
The cave where they found glittery nipple of cloths on top of the skeletons?
The nipple tassel caves are still highly studied by archaeologists.
Only the cool ones.
All right. Thank you, Alyssa, for coming for your first episode of Science Faction.
Thank you. And
thank you, audience, for listening to Science Faction 220, where you learned about anthropology, how we might have just found the newest organ in the human body, how stem cells might cure binge drinking, how solar panels can generate electricity from rain, how mouse tears actually make female mice hot, why the short-faced bear was sometimes an omnivore, and where we found the oldest Homo sapien footprints in North America. Thank you so much for joining us, and come on back next week for Science Faction 221.
Did you know that marine geologists can be sent to war even without an act of Congress?
You've been listening to Science Faction. Wait, that's not right.